Catechism, exclusively on Chai FM.
David Harris from McLaren Project, a very good morning to you. Time is 8:15. How are you?
Yep, all good. Very well, thank you. I hope you and your listeners had a really good Passover and are ready and raring to go.
Certainly we're raring. I'm not sure it's ready to go yet, but we are working on it. David, we were just chatting in studio a little bit earlier about the Syrian situation. And one thing I want to get the background from you, what's really going on there. But what I find very, very perplexing is, of course, mainstream media is covering it, but somehow we spend more time talking on social media about the minutiae within our own communities, about this person who behaves poorly, that one who's a racist, things that we really should be outraged about. But somehow we don't muster up the same outrage for these civilians who are suffering the most terrible horror in Syria. Why is that, do you think?
When I was at journalism school, we were taught the following, it's a guideline, I suppose, in terms of if you are in charge of a newsroom, in my case it was radio, how do you order the news at the top of the hour? What makes you decide what comes first? And it went like this. If one person is killed in your town, that's the top story. If 10 people are killed nationally, that's the story. If 100 people are killed overseas, that's the story. And then there was this sort of unwritten rule which said that if the people are of a different color, are particularly poor, then, you know, it takes 1,000 deaths to make the top story. And that was never said as such, but you could tell that that was the underlying message. But the truth is, tragic though it may seem, it makes sense. You know, if you go to your local store and you're talking to other shoppers that you see there, you talk about the things that you have in common. At the organization that I work for, at Clarion Project, we are an American organization, and so we try to make our website as America-centric as we possibly can. Right, because relevant. Americans are, you know, think about themselves first, and understandably so.
It's really fascinating, but quite disturbing on some level, especially when you see this level of tragedy happening across the world, certainly from us in Syria. What is the current situation?
Look, this is not the first chemical attack, and as with all the previous chemical attacks, denials come into play. The evidence does suggest that the Assad regime, including Assad, of course, the father, has been perfectly happy to use chemical weapons over the years. You need to go back to the 1980s to look at the gassing, you know, of his own people, arguably as many as 30,000 people killed in Hama way back then. So this is nothing new. We saw ISIS also seemingly using chemical weapons. There has been some suggestion that some of the other opposition groups have also during this period, but now pretty much everybody's convinced that this time it was the government turning on its own people. We're talking at least 200 people killed, and don't forget about all of the injured. And I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners saw the pictures of the children. And we're talking about a country and a people who are already suffering from PTSD, from stress, from trauma, one time after another and after another. And you may have seen, you know, the pictures of little kids having their faces being squirted with a sort of a de-chemicalizing chemical, and think, oh, well, that's all it is. And you saw the kids crying in the pictures. But think about the effect on those children of all of these individual incidents. You know, in Israel, people talked for years about the troubles being faced by the people of Sderot. And of course, I'm not belittling that at all, because, you know, the people on the Gaza border have gone through the most terrible ordeals from PTSD. But just multiply that so many times for these poor kids in Syria and their parents, and the effects are incalculable.
Yeah, you actually just wonder how this generation of Syrians, I mean, those who physically survive it, will ever do so emotionally. I mean, this is just a horror that has gone on for so many years, and there just doesn't seem to be any end to it.
Absolutely, and something that maybe has gone under the radar in international reporting is right now ISIS's resurgence includes parts of Damascus itself, the capital of the country. You know, that they're not going away. They're still absolute, I'm trying to think of a good word in English for it, but just this mix of terror groups or fighting forces throughout Syria. They change their names every Monday and Thursday, and nobody seems to know who they actually report to, who controls them. You've got organizations like Hezbollah, like ISIS, still very close to Israel's border, which of course is another factor. And we saw the attack overnight, a missile attack on Homs, on an airbase. You know, nobody knows who carried that out. It's not like, for example, the United Kingdom voting on Brexit, you know, and there's an argument, should we stay in the European Union or should we not? You're talking about the fabric of a country that started this conflict with about 20 million people in it. Of those, you know, several million have become refugees. Several million more have become IDPs. The little oil that Syria had has basically been wiped out, has been burnt out. The infrastructure, the little infrastructure the country had, has been destroyed. You know, even if you sort all of this out, and even if you get a democracy in place afterwards, or some sort of workable government, where do they pick up from? Where do they start from? And this is just Syria, and we've not begun to talk about Iraq and Yemen and Somalia and all the other places that are affected by this craziness.
And yet the world seems to be focusing on the Israel-Gaza border.
Yeah. I mean, that I actually did my master's thesis on how the British media reported on Israel at war. I've been watching Al Jazeera over the last 48 hours. And whilst clearly there are two sides to every story, and clearly some of the blame for what's happened has to be apportioned to Israel, as well, of course, as to Hamas. But if you watch Al Jazeera's reportage, the blame is only being apportioned on one side. And it beggars belief to watch the coverage. It really is shocking.
No, certainly the South African press is doing exactly the same thing. You would honestly think that that these protesters are holding a silent candlelit vigil whilst singing peace songs at the border, and Israel is mowing them down. That is the impression that is created by mainstream media. It is quite incredible. One of the things in Syria that's made this obviously very, very difficult is the fact that you have so many international countries fighting a proxy war. You've got Russia, you've got Iran. You actually really don't, nobody seems to know who is really funding and militarizing any specific area. It makes it absolutely impossible to navigate. Is there any way that this can clear, the fog can clear, that they can start to help the people of Syria?
I don't see it in the short term. Look, the Russians did make noises saying that they won't accept Iranian bases inside Syria because they realize that that's going to be destabilizing to the region. And that was the comment made by a senior official from the foreign ministry of the Russians. But, you know, he says destabilizing the region. I mean, how much more destabilized can that region become? And remember, all of this is happening in the first week that John Bolton takes over as national security advisor, to Donald Trump. And you know, Trump's already, you know, the whole world is watching him. Actually, you probably get far more reportage about Donald Trump and his behavior than you do about what's happening in Syria or anywhere else.
No, well, but in fact, CNN yesterday, I'm sorry just to interrupt you, CNN yesterday had a whole segment on the size of trousers that Donald Trump wears. And I'm thinking, right, people are being killed as we speak, and this is what CNN has chosen to focus on.
Yeah. And it's not just one part of the American media or another. It's across the board. The media reportage out of the United States, in my opinion, it is absolutely abysmal. I've worked as a journalist for over 20 years, and I've never seen anything like what the American media is like right now. And that both sides are becoming like the National Enquirer. It's pathetic. But they're focusing on Trump and on Bolton and his other appointments, and talking about them being hawks and so on. And there's world scrutiny, and all of the countries in the United Nations are following what's going on. So what does somebody like Bolton do today? When he comes into the office Monday morning and he gets all of of his boxes and you know, the all of the different crises in the world. How's he meant to react? What is the United States meant to do? Theoretically, the United States policy right now is to be fairly non-interventionist. On the other hand, you've got Putin seemingly calling a lot of the shots in Syria. And for a while I've been arguing that the Cold War is being fought right now in the Middle East and to some extent in parts of North Africa, rather than in the traditional areas of Europe. How is America meant to deal with all of this when, as you rightly say, nobody really knows who is the head of the snake, or, you know, that there's an octopus, and you can argue that either the Iranians or the Russians are controlling the octopus, but all the tentacles are heading in different directions. Which tentacles do you cut off? Because you can't, you know, if the head of all of this is Putin, you can't cut off Putin. We're not at that stage, you know, we're not in the Cold War anymore. And it makes a solution phenomenally difficult.
What does Russia have to gain by this? Is it just arms sales?
I think, first of all, that there's still the split between the West and the East. As I said, I think the Cold War is still very much alive. Mm. If you remember, there was a group of countries that was set up during the Cold War called the Non-Aligned Bloc, which is 130 odd countries, many of whom are in the Middle East, and they theoretically, traditionally, didn't vote one way or another, and you saw particularly the Russians trying to curry favor in those directions, you know, investing a lot in a place like Syria, and in exchange getting a port on the Mediterranean, and so on. The Cold War went away. What did these 130 countries have to do? Well, a lot of their time was spent in the United Nations, of course, voting against Israel. But today, with this renewed activity in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring, they've found almost a new battleground in the Middle East, and the OIC countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is 57 countries within that 130, have kind of coalesced around this subject of Syria and Iraq, and seemingly, you know, are on the same side. Most of them are on the same side as the Russians, and so the Russians get give financial support to these places, but the Russians then get, of course, voting support in the United Nations and elsewhere. And that Cold War, in my opinion, is very much alive. It might not be in the form of nukes, but it's in the form of control of individual countries and, of course, the resources they have, and world dominance and world power. And I haven't even mentioned the Chinese, who are so heavily involved in places like Sudan. And don't forget, Sudan is still a quagmire.
Absolutely, absolutely incredible. You know, you just wonder how this piece of knotted wool can ever really be untangled, and I'm just not even sure that that it can be. David Harris from the Clarion Project, thank you for your wisdom and incredible, incredibly interesting insight. We'll chat to you next week, same time, same place.